runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show 1021, Business Process Automation in 2026 with Ian Cooper. Recorded Friday, December 5th, 2025. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts, LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on X at x.com/runasradio.
Hi, this is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Today, my guest is Ian Cooper, who's a polyglot coding architect in London, founder of LDNUG, speaker, tabletop gamer, and geek. He is tattooed, pierced, and bearded, and the gov on Brighter Command. Lots of folks who heard you as Coop as well. You've got your set of names.
Yeah, so I quite often get called Coops. So for those that may not really be aware, Ian is basically just the Celtic form of John. And it's a pretty common name.
Right.
And Cooper is a trade name. Yeah. So Ian Cooper is not far removed from being John Smith.
Yeah, right. It is.
I end up working lots of places, particularly kind of my generation. There are a lot of Ians in the building often.
Yeah.
So typically I then just default to Coops. Because actually when I joined my current company, there was someone on Slack whose handle was The Ian. When I arrived, so that battle had obviously been fought, and there was no room for another Ian to contend.
Yeah, I'm not going to re-enter this battle. That's a silly thing to do.
Exactly.
Yeah, and go with the names. And you usually do talks on architecture and so forth. I've had you on .NET Rocks before back in the day.
We have, yeah, a few times.
But when you also do a lot in the area of business process automation, which I think administrators end up landing on them. Like that's the thing that folks come to me and say, like, how do we automate this? We do it every week or we do it every so often. And they've got to hopefully have a toolkit for approaching that. But I'd really be interested in your take on, you know, what do you look at when you talk about BPA and that, those kinds of things?
Yeah. And it's interesting. Actually, my current job, I actually operate out of the platform group.
Right.
Because I talk a lot about messaging, processes, that kind of thing, you live in this kind of liminal space in between, sure, the application needs some of this, but also everything else needs some of this.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is a bit of a liminal space in between. No one can quite decide. Yeah. Are you platform or are you development? And the answer is probably in between.
Yeah, for sure. Because you also look at the broader responsibilities of the feeds of data from any given app and how they'll support other things and the various ways that we tap into message streams for a given application that benefit other pieces. Like that whole bus mindset of utilizing data to its extreme takes a lot of thinking and you can't really be bound in any given application that way.
Yeah. And you know, you find stuff like, we talk about Kafka, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously Kafka can be used for a classic kind of pub sub model in parts of your application to move, events that have happened in one service to another.
Mm-hmm.
But you see effectively people using it. You know, we hook up Snowplow to it to essentially, you know, take the data coming off user interaction. We use it for our logs, right? Our logs get shipped out to Kafka and then taken off to basically to be put into a repository where we can kind of query them, etc.
Right.
So all these things are, you know, if what you're talking about is the general business of automating processes, that is true both for automating the work that your software does for its end users, and it's also true for automating the work that you internally do.
Mm-hmm.
For people, and the more you begin to think about your work internally as being, I automate things for customers within the business.
Sure.
It's the same stuff.
Yeah,
ultimately.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
They are the customer and they are dependent on what you're making.
Yeah.
It's all the same problems. You're going to get the ticket one way or the other.
Yeah. Ultimately, you know, I occasionally think about the fact that, and you and I got a bit of gray in our beards. When I first started, days of the PC revolution, most of what we funded a lot of it was we said we're going to remove the filing store.
Right.
And so, a lot of it was really just data entry, right? Mm-hmm. And at some point someone realizes, hang on a minute, you know, there's more than data entry here, right? Because you finish your job and then you pass it to the next person who does their job
mm-hmm.
and you pass it to the next person that does their job. And hey, why do we need the guy with the mail cart doing that? Maybe we could just move the work around the business, right? Yeah, yeah. And that is where business process automation comes from. I do a 2-day workshop about messaging. And one of the things I do there is model my current business, which is delivery of food or groceries to people's door mm-hmm. in paper. And I show people, I go back and say, okay, let's show you how this would have worked as a paper process. And that's always very useful, I think, when you want to think about how you automate business processes. A useful thing to think about is this idea of an inbox and an outbox on somebody's desk.
Take the technology out of the loop.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and the inbox is workers come in, I take it out of the inbox, I do something with it, right? And then I may make a couple of phone calls, which is kind of more my synchronous interactions, and I put it back in the outbox. And then that moves to somebody else who takes it out of their inbox and puts it in the outbox.
Right.
And quickly you begin to see you have this model where you get these little processing steps mm-hmm. that have some kind of inbox and outbox that you chain them together and you create an overall process.
Right.
And, you know, that has many manifestations.
Sure.
Right?
Many branching opportunities. Like as soon as the in to out is atomic, but everything before the in and after the out has possibilities.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you can combine them together in new and interesting ways, right? Mm-hmm. And you can build new, provided you think about those atomic units, you can change the process slightly, right? So typically, I mean, once upon a time, a process would be the routing slip. So some of you may have heard that term used in messaging, but a routing slip originally was a piece of paper that got attached to the front of the envelope that contained something. And it would just have a list of names. And it would say, what action should you take when you get this?
Right.
Right. And it was like retain, act, just for information.
Right.
And you would go through, you'd see your name. And
reply and forward.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Right. So that's just a very early idea of, well, there's just workflow everywhere. Mm-hmm. Right. And so a lot of what we do, I think once you get beyond the level of I'm just storing data is saying, well, how do I emulate that? In compute, how can right. I
that nature of flowing data?
Yeah, and so another thing you do, like if you run a build process, it's a workflow.
Sure, yeah, 100%.
And there's a lot of commonality and crossover between many of these tools that are often we, you know, you may take some YAML, right, and the YAML defines a series of steps. Mm-hmm. There may be something that there's then an action you take on that step, which may be some code that you run at that point, and then you put together the whole sequence of items, and you know, you run that. There are only, I think, five basic, there's a lot of academic study about workflow patterns. There are five basic patterns, and that's so the sequence, which is the simple one, where effectively it's a task followed by a task followed by a task. So you can do that, the source and the sink and a series of operations in between, right? Classically, the Unix command line, right, mm-hmm. is effectively this pipeline where I can chain things together between a source and a sink to achieve a greater outcome than one individual thing. Then there is this idea basically of a kind of an OR gate, right? Where effectively you say, I'm going to choose a path at this point. It may be two, but maybe more than two, where effectively you say, I'm going to switch between the next direction. Mm-hmm. Then there's kind of an and one, which basically says, I'm going both. So I want to do something in parallel.
Right.
And I may be splitting the work at that point to do it in parallel. And if you basically
typically both need to complete before you proceed.
Then you have a join, mm-hmm. right? At the other side, you have a join, which basically says, yeah. So that's map reduce. Okay. Right. Yeah. So you basically join together. And those are the main sort of patterns. And then there's a kind of like non-deterministic join, which kind of means everything just ends up finally arriving here. It's not kind of an explicit merge, but everything will finally go to this point.
Right. And it's very flowcharty.
Yeah, it is. You can model these things with very much with a flowchart.
Sure. No, I've always done it on a whiteboard.
Yeah.
Exactly that 100%, reason.
Right. And you just need some boxes which represent the things that happen and need some arrows that represent the flow between them. Mm-hmm. And generally, when we talk about most tools that run workflow, everything from, you know, durable functions in Azure or temporal IOs, being able to run, massive workflows for you.
Yeah.
Generally all of them, the best way to use them really is to say, I make a distinction between the workflow, which is this series of boxes.
Yeah.
And the activities that occur in those boxes, where effectively that's some code probably external to the workflow that I run.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything, once you begin to think about it, a lot of things you do day to day just really are a question of thinking about what is the workflow that I need to automate, right?
Yeah, you can easily get into tooling at that point. Like, what is the way I want to automate these things?
Right, yeah. So, but everything from GitHub Actions through Ansible, effectively, et cetera, right? All those tools are effectively ways of doing workflows for administrators. PowerShell, right? You mm-hmm. can effectively write a PowerShell script that's effectively a workflow.
Yeah.
But I think it helps to model it. I think it helps to think about it. And I think the two things to think about are, you can get very complicated, but so typically when we think about an orchestration, which is when we have something where there is somebody in charge of a workflow,
mm-hmm.
typically what we want to do is we say, I'm going to run an instance of that. And that instance is going to have some state that applies to that instance, right? So I need to think about what are the variables that basically are affected for a single run through my workflow? Where is the state living that I need to keep updating and maintaining?
Mm-hmm.
And then essentially you can then run multiple instances if you can manage multiple sets of the state in parallel to do that, right?
Right.
So, you know, a GitHub Actions workflow is essentially got a state about that run of that particular workflow. And you can run multiple in parallel because each one is tracking its state. It's tracking the artifacts that are produced. It's tracking the spin up of the various containers that you're mm-hmm. using for running your tests, etc. So as long as you can do that, as long as you can essentially say, I can manage these kind of simple steps, this kind of like sequence, exclusive or if you want to, a bit of parallelization, and manage state, you can run a workflow. And there are a lot of tools out there that will do that.
Well, and I usually only think about GitHub Actions from the context of checking in code kicks off a process to do a deployment.
Mm.
But there's no reason it couldn't be any number of other things too.
Yeah, yeah. And it's flexible enough to do a wide range of operations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are nowadays a lot of people are using them to run particular agents, right? Like code reviewing agents, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you can use them to do some transform and deployment, for example, where we have some that are really used for configuration, where someone might decide, I want to change the parameters under which the business is currently operating. Like I want to change pricing of delivery or where I'm positioning things in terms of our networks. And we can run GitHub workflows to do that, right? Someone kicks something off, goes through a series of steps and effectively results in a transformation to production.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't just, this is how I deploy stuff. It's generally useful as a tool to run an orchestrated pipeline that results.
It's also kind of self-documenting and allows you to maintain a change log. Like there's a lot of benefit from that. And I think more and more admins are starting to recognize it's worth keeping your scripts in GitHub. As soon as anybody else wants to use them or you want somebody else to understand them or you even want to keep better records of what you changed. So this idea of those, instead of just thinking in terms of script, but actually getting GitHub as part of that workflow in form of actions. So that, because it can still do all those invocations. Maybe you're just moving data around with FTP. Like you can still involve it this way.
Yeah, because you can get basically GitHub to run effectively an action that is essentially a piece of code that you want to actually use to do some transformation, right?
Yeah,
it doesn't have to just be testing. All right, it's any real executable that's running inside a container that you want to basically run the process of. And then there are obviously off-the-shelf tools like, Temporal's famous Conductor, which Netflix uses. And quite a few of those often have their origins in the more the administrator world, right? So as far as I'm aware, for example, AWS step functions were originally built at AWS.
Right.
For provisioning VMs, right? And their internal tool used to do that. And then someone goes, well, hang on a minute, generically, this just allows you to run a workflow.
Right.
So actually, people might use that to do business process as well, right? But
I've also found that these tech companies more and more make their tools public because it makes their tools better their own internal use as much as it's now another product to sell to the customer.
Right, exactly. But you, for example, you could use an Azure durable function
sure,
to run a workflow process for your admin side just as easily as you could do it for your business process side. And in some ways...
Or through with a tool like Temporal, it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And people use that for that all the time, right? It is... I have a process that consists of a number of steps and I want to automate it.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and I want to write failure paths if something fails or stoppage and roll back if we can't proceed. Like, you have choices.
And to a large extent, when people talk about platform, right? And they talk about developer experience platforms, but even any kind of internal, you know, there's this idea of, hey, maybe more than just our developer experience platform, maybe our the people that decide how our business runs need a platform, right? It's a kind of like newish idea. They're saying, well, they want to be able to tweak dials and move knobs and control how the business runs. Mm-hmm. One way they can do that is effectively that they have more of a platform that lets them do that. But all of it's just automating workflows. Really at the heart of what we mean by developer experience platforms, business platforms, any kind of platform, it is about really workflow. We have workflow internally for granting you rights to go and do some operation on Amazon. So you get temporary credentials. You literally go in, put them in your shopping cart, right?
Is this like just enough admin? I'm going to give you privileges to do this thing for now.
You put it in your shopping cart, you check it out, right? And then you basically get your privilege for now, and then a certain period of time they expire
and you're
done, right?
And no, that's cool.
It was just a workflow, right?
Well, it's always onboarding and offboarding. And like, it is interesting to think about how we standardize more of these things, not even stuck on one tool, but having a workflow tool that then invokes into other pieces for each of that. But I'm enamored of this idea of I'm going to give you your privileges through a shopping cart system where it's like, you're going to need one of these for the next hour. Off you go.
Yeah. And we literally have people, on documentation, right? How do I do X? They will literally say, you need to go to your shopping cart and grab these things, put them in the cart, and check it out, and then you can run this thing, right?
And you can run it. That's fascinating. And Ian, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for these very important messages.
Reimagine what's possible for your career, your team, your business, and for work itself at the Microsoft 365 Community Conference, April 21st to 23rd, 2026, at the Lowe's Sapphire Falls Resort in Orlando. Connect with hundreds of Microsoft executives, subject matter experts, and product makers to unlock solutions to accelerate your AI transformation. The Microsoft 365 Community Conference is your opportunity to spark inspiration, build connections, and deepen your skills. Featured speakers at the Microsoft 365 Community Conference include Jeff Teeper, President of Microsoft Collaborative Apps and Platforms, Adam Harmez, Vice President of Product, Caruana Gatima, Director of M365 Customer Advocacy, and Heather Cook, Principal PM Manager of Global Community Evangelism for M365. Listeners to Run As Radio can get a discount on registration by using the code RUNAS at m365conf.com. The Microsoft 365 Community Conference is at the Lowe's Sapphire Falls Resort in Orlando, April 21 to 23rd, 2026. Go to m365conf.com to register.
And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Ian Cooper. We're here at Build Stuff in Lithuania, chatting a little bit about various approaches to business process automation. And just recognizing there's a lot of ways to do it these days. The tools have gotten much better. And it's really just, you know, what makes sense to you and what do you need to do? Like, we are all living in slightly different landscapes. Maybe you're in Azure. Maybe you're in Amazon. Maybe you're likely in both.
And,
you know, can you really work with a set of tools that are just going to get you to all the places you need to go?
Yeah, there's the interesting history, I think, of many orgs with mergers and acquisitions and everything else is that we are in multiple clouds, but we are not multi-cloud.
Yes, that's a great point, right? It's like this group or this set of tools, we live over in AWS and we pay that, you know, fees. And then this other group's working in Azure. They don't really.
Yeah. And one of the advantages of process automation, of course, is that it can help elide those differences for you. Right. So one of the things you're often trying to do is hide the details rather than I think where you have, where essentially you have kind of a recipe, right? Here's how you achieve X, Y, and Z here. It's always worth thinking, well, potentially could I just automate that recipe, right? If I can automate that recipe, which is all really when we talk about business process automation, that's really what it is. Here's the recipe for making this, right? You can just automate that recipe for doing it. And then essentially you can, one of the things that really helps you with is the more it's like press a button and the thing works, the more I can then behind the scenes go, okay, I can retire X and replace it with Y. And you don't need to know about that.
No, it's just going to happen.
It's going to happen.
And presumably clean itself up afterwards.
Yeah, but you just keep pressing the button, right? All I need to know is the workflow is initiated by pressing the button. I have some kind of monitoring. The result comes out, right? Monitoring is useful for what we tend to call contact propensity, right? Which is, you know, you don't want everyone constantly saying to you, where is my thing?
Yeah.
What's happening, right? So the more you give them feedback, the more that lowers that propensity to say, I kicked off your process and nothing has happened.
And never had. You know, we think about modern e-commerce these days and the number of emails you get for any given order. It's like right away an email saying, we got your order. Mm. We haven't done anything about it, but we've got it. And it's like, oh, okay, now we're processing your order. Now we've packaged your order. Now we've shipped your order. You should have received your order by now. Mm. And the same thing I can see with that with a workflow. As soon as something's longer running, I mean, I would think almost any workflow, you immediately want to mesh them and says, I have received your request to run this workflow. Mm. Not saying it's done, just saying I heard you.
Yeah. So we have a system we call Message Exchange internally.
Yeah.
So Mex's job, right, is to effectively provision your message infrastructure. So the streams or queues you need, permissions on them, that kind of thing. The option we took is to basically say, okay, if you define your endpoint in async API, which is a kind of open API equivalent for messaging, and you stick it in this repo, we can then take it from that repo and we can provision all that infrastructure for you.
Right.
So we can run the workflow that does all the work. And under the hood, we actually, for that one, we use Pulumi.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the reason for that is it makes it a little easier because for some cases because of the way Pulumi works. There's a whole bunch of stuff in, say, AWS with permissions where, you know, you need to create the infrastructure and the permissions on the infrastructure, and Pulumi handles that pretty nicely.
And abstracts, so it doesn't matter what stack you're using?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the real advantage of that, though, is that from the team's point of view, there's no longer Jira tickets or anything like that, right? They can now essentially just make a change, drop it in there, get their infrastructure provisioned, and that works well. But the lessons we have really learned on that, I think, one is feedback, or else effectively the team constantly gets hammered in their channel saying, you know, I kicked this job off. Is it there? How do I figure out my infrastructure is there other than just running it, et cetera, right? And so that's the important thing. I think that when you say, I want to automate a flow where someone has previously just done all this by hand or had to raise tickets and admins then come back to the tickets.
Yeah.
They come with an implicit feedback process, right? Your ticket is complete. Therefore, you should be able to use your infrastructure.
Yes.
You have to recognize that with a workflow, I still have to give you that feedback in some way.
Whatever form that comes in.
Yeah. Otherwise, you've now made your life worse because suddenly everyone's going, I kicked off the process. I don't know whether it's there.
Yeah. Now your emails or your ticket system is the status report mechanism.
Yeah.
And you're going to be sad.
Yeah. So one step in your workflow, maybe you create a ticket and you complete the ticket just so the people who you're used to seeing tickets.
Yeah. Could see that happened.
See the ticket, right? No. And even though you go, well, I don't really need the ticket anymore.
No.
It's the way people work is so geared to that being a thing.
Yeah.
They get a reassurance. So there's a ticket. Okay, the ticket is complete. Okay, I know what's happened now.
Yeah, and I could definitely see when going upstairs, like having a class of tickets that were fully automated, executed tickets, but still gets reported out in the same system. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. It didn't cost you anything. It's not a touch point per se, but it does give a clear record that it happened, and you'll have some sense of how often it happens.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to do it there, you probably need to do that somewhere else.
Right. So, I think, because this is a classic trade-off, I think, often with automation, is people begin to feel more uncomfortable when they can't see things happening.
Yeah.
Right?
They want a spinny wheel. They want a blinky light, like some indication that something's happening.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, that those things save an enormous amount of time.
Yeah.
And they prevent – the biggest thing automating this kind of business process does is it prevents you from becoming a bottleneck and taking the blame. Right. Because it's very easy for someone to blame the kind of admin side and say, oh, it's all admin's fault, basically. You know, they were stacked up, couldn't get our stuff done, right? I mean, I remember back in the day when which it sounds like another universe, right? Yeah. When we had somebody in the company whose job was to run the build process.
The build master.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
And you would literally queue up waiting for your build. I mean, I don't know why, but it just sounds ridiculous now. You queue up waiting for the guy to do your build.
Right, but he was the one with all the Word docs on how that build was actually going to happen.
Yeah.
And also knew when they were wrong.
So, and he's the guy after work, you always made sure you bought him a drink.
Right.
Because that might get you further up the line, right? And we literally, I worked for a company that had to overflow an office, right? So it's an insurance company. So it was nice. I overflowed into the Lloyd's building.
Yeah.
I was in the different office to the build guy. And the build guy was always responding to the guy that was three desks over doing their build, right? So occasionally we literally had to send a member of the team over to go and sit with the build guy.
To get time.
To get our build done, right? Yeah. And now, of course, you know, we just all just make that workflow, all right? And what happened is we removed that point of contention, which was the individual who needed to actually run the workflow rather than us self-servicing. But it also removed a whole excuse from us, which is, why haven't you shipped yet?
Yeah.
Couldn't get build time.
Yeah, no, you can't say that anymore.
Yeah, right.
You can say the build process is broken.
Yeah.
That's about it.
But I think that anything, it is the most effective way to scale. And it is the most effective is to look at what processes you have and ask, can I just automate those out of existence, right?
Yeah. But still have to fill in all the gaps so that people know what's going on.
Yeah.
And more saliently, when it goes wrong, you have some way to compensate.
Right. And then you get into slightly the other thing I talk about, is the difference between orchestration and choreography, right? And so, this comes up slightly less in this kind of experience, if you have two orchestrations that need to talk to each other, one kicks off another, you have this point of kind of indeterminacy in between, right? Where my thing finishes and sends some kind of communication. The other one should receive it and kick off. And that's where the problem comes of, this one finished, but that another one never started, right?
Right.
So that's where that's technically what we call a choreography. It's the flow between the various orchestrations.
The various steps of the workflow.
And that's the area of uncertainty. And that is where effectively you need to start thinking about how do I retry?
Yeah. How do I know it failed from a supervisory role and decide, am I retrying or do I need to roll back or do I need to kick it upstairs?
Yeah.
So that's the orchestrator's role.
So generally speaking, the orchestrator that sent the message, what you want to be able to do is resend your final message. That's you to kick off something later in the stream. And the thing later in the stream has to be able to cope with the idea of I'm going to be resent a message. If I've completed, it's fine. I can ignore it.
Right.
If not, then essentially I may need to redo the work. You can get very sophisticated, but most things don't support this, which is to say, I send the message from the first, it goes to the second, and the second says, I've completed my work. What I need to do is send my final message because there's somebody else downstream of me that needed that particular message who may not have been the thing that's kicked off. And that means I can always re-kick off that work from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And that simplifies my, your job failed, what do I do? I just go back to the start and kick off the start.
Right.
Because then I don't have to figure out where did it fail, because I just know I can re-kick off the process and everything will say, did I complete? If I completed, send the message. If I didn't complete, I was the thing that went wrong. I need to rerun, right? The problem as soon as you get into choreography is understanding where you are. That's also where things like climatry come in, right? Mm-hmm. So
climatry?
Open telemetry. So,
or telemetry.
Telemetry, yeah. So OTEL and stuff, because that gives you essentially, the ability to view spans that essentially, it's very useful for an orchestration. It will tell you what happened in your given orchestration so you can review it. But you can also get a distributed one, which will show you, did I actually cross over to the next step? And I can see that running. Overall, telemetry is very useful for being able to debug workflows.
Right.
Because it, that span, which tells you what are the activities that happened, is essentially your key to understanding the span is effectively the workflow and the activities are the various sequence items in the workflow. And I can therefore review that telemetry data to understand what happened to a given job.
Right.
And therefore I can debug it. So the problem always with any kind of workflow is how do I debug that, right?
And so how do I have a log of what actually happened and possibly when it went wrong? And
so you need some form of telemetry, right? Now, if I'm on GitHub or whatever, GitHub's going to give me a lot of that without being actual OTel, right? GitHub Actions is going to tell me where all the steps it's on. If I'm building my own thing, that's what I want to look for is how do I know what happened in the workflow? Mm-hmm. So I can debug the problem.
Where the problems actually exist. Because it's rarely going to happen in front of you. It's going to be a particular case.
Yeah. It's usually an edge case where, and often it's like data was out of a particular expected range mm-hmm. and you didn't know what to do in that situation or was missing, right? And then you just better to learn to cope with those and give better errors back to the people that come and created it in the first place.
Yeah. And somehow push it back. And rollback doesn't come for free either. So, you know, if you...
No.
That's not a simple thing.
Rollback is never a simple thing because usually you hit this trade-off point of do I just kind of like abandon, right?
Yep.
And then let a human being try and correct wherever we went to.
Yeah.
Do I reverse everything, right? Or do I reverse back to the last known good step and automatically try and retry from there? And there are a lot of choices there about whether you think you would ever succeed, right? Mm-hmm. If you retried or you just want to unwind the whole thing. And typically you need a reversing operation for every operation
that you create. So you write the script to do the thing, but you also have to write the script to undo
the thing. Yeah. So how can I reverse this operation so that I can roll it all the way back? Could I roll back just to the last good step and retry that? Mm-hmm. Generally, that's where off-the-shelf workflow engines really excel for you because typically they have thought about that problem space and will have effectively mechanisms built in to say, okay, here is your rollback path. What is the rollback I run when this fails? And it just simply reverse the workflow for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is the trick.
Use some tools that are built for that. Don't do this by hand.
I mean, you can if it's small enough, right? Yeah, if it's a small enough thing and you want to write a bash script and it's two or three, but just think about how do I reverse the things that I've done?
Yeah.
And typically, you just want to run another flow, which is a reversing flow, right? Either you can reverse the flow mm-hmm. or you just mirror the flow that you've got and say, okay, my reversing flow needs to run.
Right.
You then get the problem, my reversing flow doesn't run.
Yes. So I need the reversing flow?
Well, no, at that point, practically, you declare bankruptcy.
Kick it upstairs.
I talk about a human being becoming involved, right?
Good luck with this. Thanks. Here's some telemetry.
Right. At some point, we human beings still get needed, right?
Need to intercede.
Yeah.
Well, I've certainly seen in some organizations very elaborate onboarding scripts and they fail halfway through. And now you have orphan accounts and things like the bigger issue being when you go to run the script again, you know, certain stuff already exists in the uncompleted version, which now impairs a rerun.
Yeah.
So it's like being able to think through a workflow like that, that's recoverable. It doesn't get into a stuck state where they've got to go to IT to get that person onboarded now.
Yeah,
it failed in some way.
There's a notion out there called crash-only software, right?
Right.
Which is this idea that you assume the only reason a program terminated and someone is rerunning it is mm-hmm. because it failed.
Right.
So your first step is to figure out how far did you get mm-hmm. and what do you need to do next? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in a sense, with those kind of onboarding scripts, classically, you need to understand, have some kind of manifest that tells you what are the things that you intend to do. What are the tests to check whether that's been done? So at startup, you effectively say, okay, I'll start at the top of the manifest and figure out what I need to do. And it may be, oh, it's the first time I'm being run by the looks of it. I'm starting at the beginning.
Right.
Or it might be, oh, well, it looks like I've got as far as step 10.
Yeah.
But now I need to go to 11 and keep working.
Yeah, keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where I think these orchestrator tools can come in handy too, where they can think in the meta between the different tasks.
Yeah, effectively, because they often defining like a YAML version of that workflow, right? They do have the ability to mark state of the workflow, know how far it was, and they're built to resume. And it is this idea we tend to typify as durable execution, right?
Yeah.
So durable execution essentially means I will eventually complete your script.
Yeah.
I may crash because the machine crashes halfway through.
Internet was grumpy or any number of reasons, but I'll get there.
But something will resume it at some point mm-hmm. and then pick up where we were last at, which is usually the last good point.
Yeah.
Where we last point, we checkpointed and said, we are here. So I have to assume maybe that effectively if I come to a point where I'm restarting after a checkpoint, maybe I was a little way through this thing and I might declare up first to check that I haven't got half-built directories or whatever that are essentially are full of junk. And I clear that up, and then I keep moving from that next step on. So it's this whole thing of don't assume just because I'm doing this next step that all my directories effectively are not there.
Right.
Clear them out if I'm going to do the whole step beforehand, and then start working. Because assume you crashed, right?
Yeah.
Assume you crashed on this step and there's stuff that needs cleaning up.
Yeah, and it's fair. It's just you have to think more broadly about how all of that works. So they get more elaborate, but they also get more resilient too.
Yeah, I mean, I always used to remember places where effectively when you onboarded, you know, you had two jobs. The first was to run the onboarding script, and the second was to fix the onboarding script for the next guy.
True enough. Or at least fix up that person so they were operational, and maybe we'll get around to fixing the script.
Yeah, no, I worked one place where we were pretty militant about, you know, you got to fix the script, basically, because get a guaranteed, it's like 6 months since the last person onboarded.
Yeah, and it's going to be wrong.
Things have changed.
Yeah, for sure.
And no one bothered to maintain it in the meantime. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to go through it.
But no, I think certainly manifests, right? Understanding what it is that thing needs to do as a series of workflow steps is really useful, because that creates that whole model that you can say, with each step, the first thing I do is test whether that step's been run, clear out anything that may be detritus from when I crashed, then do the step, right? And then when I've completed that step, move on to the next one. I need to keep track for you of what state I think you last reached, right? I mean, it's like it's like running any application. You need to manage a little bit of state. You need to figure out, you know, which run of this am I on, right? And that tends to be pretty helpful.
Yeah, no, challenging. Ian, I've grabbed a few links along the way for folks who want to look at some of these tools, but I really appreciate your thinking on this, because we are making more and more complex features here in most organizations. And I don't want to say we're programmers anymore, but it's a lot of code. And it is that sort of coder thinking of what happens if this fails, what happens if it succeeds. Like, it's those problem spaces. It's kind of the same.
100%. You know, both groups are effectively dealing with data and automation of business processes.
Sure.
It's just your customer is different.
Yeah,
right?
That's a fair assessment. Thanks again for coming on Run As Radio.
Hey, lovely to see you again.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.